I'm very happy now to welcome Ben Althaus. He is a mathematical epidemiologist. He is an Omidyar Fellow at the Santa Fe Institute. And we are here to talk about the Science on Screen series. He will be introducing the film Panic in the Streets at the CCA on Monday, the 31st of March at 7 in the evening. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
The Science on Screen series is just terrific. Basically, scientists from the Santa Fe Institute get to pick a film, introduce it, then the film gets screened, then you do a Q&A afterwards. And the film that you chose, Panic in the Streets, which was made in 1950, it's a total film noir, shot on location in New Orleans. It's really cool, but it's about a plague.
Right.
Or a potential, it's about plague and a potential epidemic. When did you first see this film? Do you remember?
I first saw it just a few weeks ago, actually. My colleague Sam Scarpino and I were talking about doing one of these Science on Screens, and we picked this one. And I watched it, and it's just a fantastic film.
It's a film, first of all, with, we have to say, Richard Widmark, Jack Palance, and Zero Mostel,
yep,
who are all fabulous. But it's about a disease. Now, first of all, is it an actual disease or
yes,
not?
That absolutely. Is, yes, okay. It's plague. It's a pneumonic plague, which is different from the Black Death, which was called bubonic plague, which affected the lymph nodes. Pneumonic plague affects the lungs. And can actually be transmitted person to person and not through a flea.
Right. Yeah. And so that's what makes it really dangerous.
Exactly, yes.
And in the film, you have kind of gangsters and bad guys, and basically they're trying to find out how it's transmitted, but of course it's hard to find these guys because they don't want to be found because they're
right.
Crooks.
That's right. It's wonderful. You have this classic film noir detective as well as a disease detective played by the doctor who is basically just concerned with controlling the disease. They have this guy that was found. I don't want to give too much away from the film, but he was found shot after presumably a loss at a gambling. And basically they do an autopsy and his lungs are filled with bacteria. And so they call the doctor and the doctor comes in and realizes immediately what it is and starts to panic, trying to figure out what exactly the disease is and then where how to track it and then find all of the contacts potentially this person had. And
one of the questions in it, which I think is a question that probably all epidemiologists, especially those working actively in public health, have to deal with is, when do you tell people?
Right, exactly. And so the doctor is constantly battling. He's worried about the threat of fear. Basically, you yell plague in a crowded city or in an auditorium and people start to panic. It happened in India, I'm not sure, a few years ago. There was reports of an outbreak and over 500,000 people left a city just out of word, and it turned out there wasn't any plague. And so they strike this balance in the film of trying to find cases, but also not alert the public and incite panic.
And so the film is called Panic in the Streets, but it's actually as much about avoiding panic in the streets as there is any actual panic. And that's something, I mean, how do you study that as an epidemiologist? I mean, you're perhaps more on the research side of it, but how do public health people make those decisions?
Absolutely. It's a very difficult decision because on one hand, you want to not incite fear, but on the other, you really want to track diseases. And oftentimes, getting the public involved is a great way to identify further cases, stop the spread of things, go get vaccinations could be an example, or wash your hands, or cough into your sleeve. Basically, it's important to get the public involved, but you have to do it with tact. You don't want to say, we have this emerging disease, we don't know what it is, it could kill your family. You want to approach it in a way that can get people involved and make them aware, but not scare them.
And the fear in this film, Panic in the Streets, is that people would leave town and then spread the disease all over the state, the country, whatever.
Exactly. There's a scene in the film that I really, really enjoyed. Basically, the doctor is, it's towards the end, and he says, in 10 hours, I could be anywhere in the United States, and tomorrow I could be in Africa. And that's part of it. So if you flee and you're sick, you can infect not only your neighbor or your people in your household, but you can infect people in the next town or in the next city. And this is exactly what happened in 2009, H1N1. It rapidly spread around, and that wasn't due to fear. That was just due to day-to-day travel, but the fear-induced travel could spread many more cases, as you said.
When you have an airborne illness, what are the factors that influence how fast it spreads compared to, say, a disease that's transmitted through, well, like the cholera epidemic, you know, infected water supplies, or fluid contact between people, like a sexually transmitted disease?
Exactly. Well, basically, there are factors affecting the virus or the bacteria itself, whether where exactly in the lungs does it sit? Does it sit in your throat? Does it sit on the top of your lungs, the base of your lungs? That affects how much you breathe and cough. It also affects, it's also is affected by the symptoms that are given. Basically, whooping cough is caused by a bacteria that causes lots of coughing, exactly. And you spew lots of bacteria into the air by coughing. And so you have these symptoms, and it's an evolutionary aspect of the bacteria. It causes you to cough, and you can spread to many cases. Pneumonic plague, actually, while very, very fatal, doesn't cause a lot of coughing until the very last stages of the disease when you're really sick and not moving. And so you end up dying, but the chances of you spreading because you're laid up in bed and coughing blood full of bacteria actually are lower.
So, what about the incubation period? In other words, I think many of us, or maybe not, but I know that I sometimes lie awake thinking about kind of disaster scenarios of various kinds, including, let's say there was a deadly virus with a 4-week incubation period, mm-hmm. and it was an airborne virus. By the time you know you have it, you might have spread it to so many different people.
Exactly. The worst virus you can imagine, basically you would become infected and be able to transmit it, but not show too many outward symptoms. Basically, if you're coughing, it could be any number of things, but if it's some deadly virus and you could be coughing and walking around and talking to people, that is definitely a concern. And luckily there aren't any viruses that are out there. I mean, SARS is very deadly, and that spread around the world many very rapidly about 10 years ago, as we all remember. That would be the absolute disaster scenario, as you said. Yeah.
So how do epidemiologists gather the data? I mean, basically, people are living their own lives, and they don't really think about the fact that they might be a data point.
Right, exactly. So one of the biggest ways that we do it now is physician reporting. So, for example, if you go in to see your doctor and he or she suspects that you have the flu, they can do a test and they report that test to the CDC. And so basically the CDC gathers all these data and tries to predict the next epidemic from that. You can also have active case finding. So basically if you know that there's an outbreak or several cases of some bizarre disease, you can go in there and survey and try and find additional cases, kind of feather it out. That's called active case finding. You can also, and this is something that I've been working on recently, you can use things like Google or Twitter to try and identify signals of sickness. So let's say someone goes online and they Google symptoms of flu or symptoms of the cold. You can use those data to then, you know, fit with actual case data to try and predict levels of incidence across the United States and across the world. And those methods are good. They give an estimate, but it's still just that, just an estimate.
Can you, using Google and Twitter data, can you pinpoint locations, like towns, where things are coming from, where Google search is coming from?
Yeah, so the data provided by Google are aggregated and masked to protect privacy of individual searching. But there are geographic-specific locations and predictions that you can make using those data. It's a little coarse, but you can get down to state level. I mean, that's exactly what Google Flu Trends reports, is state-level estimates of current activity, influenza activity. You do see, as you would expect, big differences across the United States in flu incidents.
So let's say you've got some data that in northern New Mexico, there's a real spike in people searching on certain search terms like fever, cough, I don't know, what's mm-hmm. like whatever the search terms are for their let's say their symptoms. What do you do then?
Well, so basically you can take those searches and you can try and come up with statistical estimates, as I said, of the true cases. Some of the problems with the data, of course, are People could be searching for themselves. They could be searching for their kid. They could be searching because they heard about it on the news and they wanted to find out what it was. So it gives just a hint, an idea of what's going on, and you always have to back it up with true data. But I think it holds great promise when you combine it with these true CDC data to get a good idea of the level of flu.
Now, this kind of research is not dangerous for the epidemiologist, but I would think in other kinds of research where you're actually talking to people, part of what you would have to learn is how to protect yourself from the diseases you're studying.
Absolutely. So I'll talk about on Monday the Epidemiology Intelligence Service, which was started in 1951 after the threat of biological warfare coming out of the Korean War and going into the Cold War. And these guys really have feet on the ground. They're trained epidemiologists. They compete to go into this two-year training program, and they're sent all over the world to investigate bizarre outbreaks. And so basically these guys were sent in 1976 to Sudan and Nigeria to investigate these hemorrhagic fever viruses, which turned out to be Ebola. But they don't know. They go into the ground, they take their precautions, but they're flying into the wind. They don't know what they're doing, and they do. They're very specifically trained to protect themselves and wear masks, and they know all of these methods of decontamination. But they're really the cowboys of epidemiology.
Going into the field and studying Ebola is not my idea of something to put on your to-do list.
No, not myself either.
That's a very, very scary disease.
It is. It is quite scary. Yeah. It is quite scary. I don't want to give away too much of what I'm talking about on Monday, but that may make an appearance.
Ah, okay. So we're talking to Ben Althaus, who is a mathematical epidemiologist at the Santa Fe Institute, and he will be at the CCA on Monday talking about the film Panic in the Streets. Now, tell us more about what it means to be a mathematical epidemiologist.
So basically, in contrast to those epidemiologists that go on the ground to go investigate Ebola, or even those epidemiologists that work for the state health department collecting data from physicians, I take those data and build both statistical and other mathematical models to try and predict future incidents. So I build models bringing in Google and Twitter search data, but I also build models trying to understand the way that diseases are transmitted in populations. So if, for example, you had an individual who was infected with some virus or bacteria, they went into a susceptible population, what are the chances that it would reach lots of people in the population? What are the chances it would reach small numbers of people in the population? I also ask questions, if you have a treatment, say antibiotics or a vaccine, what's the best way to distribute those? Should you give it to certain individuals? Should you target young? Should you target old? These are questions that you can't test in reality because you just need to give vaccine to everybody. But you can use math to really understand what may happen under different scenarios.
When you study different scenarios, there are psychological factors, like whether you believe the authority figure who's telling you what to do.
Mm-hmm. That's actually a project we're gearing up now. What are the effects of human behavior on disease transmission and vice versa? If I'm sick, do I stay home because I don't want to affect others? If my coworker is sick, do I steer clear from them? Do I change my hand-washing behavior? How do all of these affect disease transmission? The state of the modeling is new. These projects have just been taking on. A lot of it has to do with computing power. The technology has now gotten to the point where you can ask questions about individual behavior, whereas before you had to kind of take more of an aggregate view of population-level processes.
And it's probably most difficult in sexually transmitted diseases where there's a greater tendency to not quite tell the truth.
Absolutely. There's something called social desirability bias, where basically it's exactly that. You may not report a risky sexual contact because you know it's wrong, and so that will skew estimates of the data that we use. And then human beings are interesting creatures. It's really hard to capture all of these psychological processes in the models. We can try, but we have to make assumptions about what the behavior would be in certain scenarios.
When you look at the field of epidemiology and, I mean, I think of, you know, I don't know much about it, but thinking about the cholera epidemic and the chlorination of water, and, I mean, these are huge breakthroughs both in the method of studying disease and then what to do about it. What have been some of the breakthroughs in epidemiology since then?
Well, the biggest one would be antibiotics, certainly. Basically, before this time, we had no treatment for many common diseases that would kill people, basically. Whooping cough, plague, basically, if you got the plague before antibiotics, it was almost uniformly fatal. Now it's can be cured very reliably. I would say beyond antibiotics, we have vaccination. Vaccination is a huge boon to public health. Basically, the best way to stop a disease is to keep people from getting it in the first place. And so not only do you stop cases, which helps populations on a whole, but you help the individual because then they don't get sick themselves. And so just the fact that we can vaccinate against polio and influenza and measles has just saved millions, countless numbers of lives. And then beyond that, I'd say, as you say, sanitation and further just knowledge. I mean, having a knowledge of what is actually affecting you allows you to protect against it and treat it once you have it. Yeah.
How are epidemiologists dealing with the reality of resistant strains that come from the prescription and overprescription of antibiotics?
Well, there's lots of work. I've thought a lot about it. In the context of flu, basically resistance of flu to the current antivirals. It's a huge problem, and it's becoming a larger problem. So there's constant revisions to the guidelines. Basically, when do you treat a child with otitis media, an ear infection? Should you wait until it's confirmed a bacteria, or should you go ahead and treat right away? And there's all kinds of work that I do, thinking about what would be the chances, what would be the outcome if we had large levels of resistance in the population. So if a flu strain came out that was completely resistant to the current antivirals, what's the best way to go about that? Because you've lost one of your frontline ways to fight it.
In places like Santa Fe, there's so much of a focus on herbal medicine and other forms of kind of more, you know, close to the ground. I don't even know if they should be called alternative because they were the medicine that preceded the industrial medicine that we have now. How do those come into your work, if they do?
They come in a few ways, not so much herbal medicine, but basically vaccination refusals. There's a large hypothesis that some of the resurgence in whooping cough, for example, is due to pockets of unvaccinated individuals for whatever reason. And so basically that can definitely affect the way that we think about transmission. You can make assumptions and models that everyone becomes vaccinated, but really if this heterogeneity can really throw off the way that diseases travel through populations. And so I am thinking about it a lot.
That's actually such an interesting example of the psychological effect of people's ideas on public health, which is there's this idea which has been so completely refuted that vaccinations are somehow bad for you, and the people who hold those ideas won't let go of them.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And there's very little the scientific community can do besides keep presenting good science and saying it's our recommendation that you yourself become vaccinated and you vaccinate your children, for example. It continues to be a very large problem, of course, for public health and really the future of health in this country and around the world.
Ben Althaus is a mathematical epidemiologist. He's an Omidyar Fellow at the Santa Fe Institute. Now, are you here for several years?
Yeah, I'm here. I started in early September, and I'm here for another 3 years. Basically, I have funding through 3 years, and I'm writing grants now, and if I get those, I can stay for another two.
Excellent. Well, we hope to talk to you more about this amazing subject. And meanwhile, on Monday night, the 31st of March, we will see you at the CCA, the Center for Contemporary Arts here in Santa Fe, where you will be talking about the film Panic in the Streets. Once again, it's a 1950 film noir with Richard Widmark, a fabulous Jack Patton. talents playing such a great bad guy.
Great movie. Yeah.
Great movie. Zero Mostel, directed by Aliyah Kazan. And 7 o'clock at the CCA for tickets. And sometimes these things sell out, so you may want to call in advance. It's 982-1338. Ben, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.